Katie Cohn Granos. I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. Yes, one of those. I am the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships for better, for worse, forever. Discover the Path to Lasting Love. It's certainly a book that I wish that I had had when I began my own relationship life, because the book teaches us exactly how to assess. And yes, assess, I know it's not sexy, it's not romantic, but it is terribly important, particularly these days, to really know who your partner is and is not, given so many of the scams that we're seeing on the online dating sites. I'm also the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach. I'm a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest. And I can hardly believe it. I've been hosting the Ask Beatty Show here on the Progressive Radio Network for almost 9 years. And I have a private practice in New York City and also in East Hampton. And people are always asking me, so what is your show really all about? Well, in one word, it is about empowerment. We talk about all of the things, and there are many things in our lives that we need to actually do to improve the quality of our lives, of our mental health, of our physical health, and our relationships. So we do. We talk a lot about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships. And I have a mantra, and I've really been hoping over all of these years that somehow you will also take in this mantra in your own life. And that mantra is, be willing to acknowledge, be honest with yourself, and address and resolve as best as we can the things that continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships. And one of the things that I really hope that I've convinced you over all these years is that we do not need to navigate this journey on our own. And that reaching out to family and friends, hopefully they're loving, positive family and friends, and if need be, professionals, really does make our life journey easier and less isolated, alienated, and lonely. And every week, I have some questions, the same questions that I want you to seriously think about. And this is the How Are You Doing segment. And this really requires a lot of honesty on your part. So looking at your mental health, so how are you doing? You know, how is that depression, the anxiety? Perhaps some of you are dealing or maybe not dealing with substance abuse issues of various different kinds, or earlier traumas that so many people have sustained growing up in their families, early child sexual abuse, and a variety of other traumas. And look, the reality is, and we know this, we cannot change our history. We can't change anything that's happened even a second ago. But what I have found as a psychotherapist practicing for many, many years is that there really is a very good way to help people to emotionally process what did and did not happen in their lives. And in that way, we're really able to get to a place, not a perfect place, because perfection, as we know, does not exist, but a better place where we're living our life in ways that are really in our best interest. And that is what the key is, living our lives in ways that are in our best interest without going through our days and our weeks and our months and our years with really one foot in the past and one foot in the present. So again, looking, be willing to look at your mental health, your relationships, abuse of various different kinds, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and what about your physical health. I mean, so many people, we talk about losing weight and get into shape, and yet it becomes more of a wish or more of a dream than actually be willing to say, okay, today is a new day, and I'm going to start to do some positive things that will help to improve my physical health. And what about your sleep? I mean, we know the studies tell us that we need about 7 to 8 hours of restful sleep. And I know these days, you know, I hear from friends, I hear from patients, our people are up day and night and they're on their devices looking at the computers and looking at the likes and looking at Facebook. And it's had a lot of detrimental effects. to our physical as well as to our emotional well-being. And when I ask you all of these questions, you know, I think the most important question is, if things are not working as well as you might like in a couple of different areas, the real issue, the real question is, what are you willing to do about it? Because it's very, very difficult sometimes to be truthful, to really be honest with ourselves. And yet, what is it that keeps us in this downward spiral? Well, it happens to be our avoidance, denial, our blame, our self-blame, and our defensiveness. And we tend to go around and round in circles. But like my late father used to tell me, you know, you wake up in the morning and every day it is a new day with new possibilities. And we absolutely are able every single day, sometimes with help or without help, to navigate a new route in life if we are really serious. So these are the questions. This is the mental and physical health checkup that I ask you to take every single week on the Ask B Show. Well, today we are not going to be talking about mental health exactly, but of course, plastic surgery and looking beautiful and looking and feeling good about yourself. Of course, it has a very, very strong mental health component to it. But we're going to be talking about cosmetic surgery. And in a couple of minutes, I'm going to introduce a really terrific guest, somebody who I like, somebody who I admire, and somebody who is honest, and somebody who actually does some really, really great work. But as I was researching the show, it was interesting to find out that the global cosmetic surgery industry is a $50.67 billion industry in 2018, and it is projected to reach almost $67 billion by 2026, and trends indicate that it is likely to gain traction from the ever-increasing number of patients undergoing procedures such as facelifts and rhinoplasty and chin augmentations and breast reductions, and the list goes on and on. So that in 2018, Americans spent $16.5 billion on combined surgical and non-surgical aesthetic procedures, and that number is rising every year. And cosmetic surgery, guess where it is the most popular? Well, it is in the United States, Brazil, Mexico, and Germany, according to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. Almost 18 million people underwent surgical and minimally invasive cosmetic procedures in the United States in 2018. However, and this is something all of you listeners really need to take in right now, all plastic surgeons and professionals who work in the aesthetic world, like all therapists, are not the same. And any doctor, and this is really scary, from a dermatologist to an oral surgeon can call himself a cosmetic surgeon. So what do we have to do as consumers to protect ourselves from the thousands of ads and the likes and the reviews from practitioners who have minimal training and expertise? In fact, in a recent article by a man, Marshall Allen, I'm a journalist. Apparently, I'm also one of America's top doctors. It's a horrifying article about how this writer was able to get, believe it or not, an American top doctor award by simply buying a plaque. But my guest today, Dr. Barry Weintraub, is indeed a leading board-certified plastic surgeon in New York City and East Hampton with over 30 years of bona fide experiences. And Dr. Weintraub specializes in high-quality, detailed cosmetic surgery of the face and body, which I have seen, employing cutting-edge approaches to treatments. And his philosophy, which I love, is less is more, and that results should be conservative and understated with a keen eye toward natural beauty. So, Dr. Weintraub, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Ask Beauty Show. So good to see you.
Good afternoon, Beauty. I must say that introduction of what your show puts out was one of the best I've ever heard. There's so many people out there with anxiety for so many different reasons, and indeed, every day is a new day.
No, exactly. And I have to tell you, I don't know whether you know or not, but I'm in Sarasota right now, so that if you were here, we would be together doing the show in person, and then we'd be out on the tennis courts.
Ah, sounds fun.
So here we are. So really, what do we do to protect ourselves from all the ads and all the stuff on the computer so that we're not going to end up with really botched looks like I see so many men and women have? What to do?
Well, what you do is you first look in the mirror. And if you see something that's rising to the level of upset, and you don't want to look at it day after day, that's the time to pick up the telephone. Many of these things are small items that don't need surgery. I will refuse about 25 to 30% of patients because they are just not great candidates. But if you see something that you feel needs attention, you would only look up a board-certified plastic surgeon. That means an individual who has been certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery. And there is only one American Board of Plastic Surgery, which originated in 1939. And as you were alluding to, there are all kinds of characters with all kinds of boards and names they give themselves. And they really are not trained in detailed cosmetic surgery. My education was about 15 years, and it encompasses cosmetic as well as other subspecialties. But if you start to see a dentist putting in breast implants or an ear, nose, and throat person doing liposuction, you have to have a little antenna go up. It is someone who is certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery.
Uh-huh. So that's something, please, people who are listening right now, and if you were contemplating contacting an expert person, the American Board, that's really the key to look for, right?
Right. The American Board of Plastic Surgery. And I'm not talking about the American Board of Facial Plastic Surgery. That is a board that was created only about 15, 20 years ago by ENT people who are trained in head and neck surgery, ear problems, nose problems, throat problems, who have seeped into cosmetic surgery, but the consumer doesn't know it. So exactly, the American Board of Plastic Surgery.
Okay, very interesting for people to hear and also to take in. And a lot of people wonder, you know, how early is too early to begin having surgical and non-surgical procedures without becoming overly obsessed with our looks?
Great question. The time to pick up the telephone is, as I said, when you look in the mirror and you are at the level of upset where you don't want to see it anymore. But some gradual or some rough guidelines for certain procedures are as follows. Ear surgery, where the ears are very protrusive, can be done anytime after the age of 6 in children because they are the target of abuse by other children their age. The ears are 90% developed by age 6. So if they're way, way out, we can pin them back. Mm-hmm. Rhinoplasty. The cutoff age in girls is 14. Mm-hmm. The cutoff age in boys is 15. Above 14 in girls or above 15 in boys, you can change the configuration of the nose, which is composed of bone and cartilage. There, too, it's about 95% adult. Breast augmentation, breast reduction, never to be done before 18 years of age.
Uh-huh.
Those surgeries, you should wait till you're at least 18 just to see what you really have. And 18, 19, is fine. You also have a whole slew of non-invasive procedures, Botox, fillers, lasers, peels, threads, PRP, bioidentical hormones. All of those can be done after about 21. And similarly, eyelids, facelifts, usually grab people, I will say in California, a little earlier. I've seen them as young as 40. Mm-hmm. But I would say the major group of facial resuspension surgery is between 50 and 70 plus. Now, I say plus because you can have an 80-year-old who's in excellent medical condition and gets medical clearance by their doc. And if they have clearance, we can get them through a terrific procedure. Mm-hmm. So there are different ages for different procedures.
So the thing is, a consumer, I mean, with all of these different options, it's really about finding a surgeon like yourself who can explain the pros and the cons. For example, you know, you mentioned breast augmentation, breast lift, breast reduction. There's so many things that we as a consumer know nothing about. So that we need to trust the person who we are having the consultation with to say, yes, it's A, or no, it's B.
You must be with someone that you trust. Otherwise, right. You cannot move forward.
Exactly. So tell me, what happens, or tell us, what happens when somebody comes to see Dr. Barry Weintraub in New York City or in East Hampton for an initial consultation? What goes on?
So what happens is, the patient is placed in the treatment room. Mm-hmm. I politely knock on the door, sit down, and I give them the mirror. And for a facial situation, the mirror must be held with the eyes in the mirror parallel with the floor. It's called horizontal gaze. Mm-hmm. For the body, we can look in a full-size mirror. But I then ask the patient to tell me in their own words, mm-hmm. and point at the same time as to what brings them in today that's bothering them. And I want to hear it from the patient, not from a pushy mother. Right. I want to hear it right from the words of the individual who's having the consultation, what it is they see that they want improved. And then I can move on from there and make decisions as to how much I can improve whatever they're seeing. Or I ask permission if they'd like my professional judgment at the end, but I never solicit it.
Interesting. Do you also, and I don't think I've ever asked you this in person, but do you also get into people's mental health status? I mean, somebody may, you know, just be overly obsessed, overly depressed, overly anxious, and hoping that, you know, Dr. Barry Weintraub, he's going to do a cosmetic surgery procedure and all is well. Do you get into that as well?
I absolutely get into that. And I consider myself fortunate because I also have a degree in psychology. I majored in biochemistry, but I wound up with a separate one in psych. And I'm constantly looking and listening very, very carefully. Uh-huh. Because you don't want to catch someone who's right off of a divorce and they think this is going to cure their life, right. Or is having some other emotional problem with all sorts of drugs. And then they wake up and they're hysterical and they don't want to embrace what they've seen. So if I find that sort of individual, a psychiatric consultation is in order.
Uh-huh. And what's really great is that you're forthcoming about it. So there are no secrets going on in your office. You're asking people, they're telling you, you're giving them your, you know, expert opinion. And then you're able to make a decision to move forward or not, right?
Right, correct. And that's why I send them to you.
Right. So tell me, what percentage of people would you say, you know what, I understand you're unhappy with this or that part of your body, but I think that maybe now is not the right time, or perhaps this is not where I think you should be going at this point in your life, given other circumstances that are happening?
Well, as I mentioned before, I refuse about 25 to 30% of potential patients for any number of reasons. If, for example, unrealistic expectations, I mean, I'll ask patients to bring me in pictures of, let's say, noses they like, mm-hmm. or jawlines and faces mm-hmm. they like. Mm-hmm. And I'm there to tell that patient, if I can reproduce that or get close to it, I'll tell them I can. If I can't, I won't. So that element of the consult is very important.
No, very, very much so. Do you find that people more and more are wanting to move away from surgical procedures and try and make themselves look, you know, better and feel better with the variety? And you were mentioning all of the non-surgical procedures that are available to us today.
Well, aside from the mandatory younger ages of ears at 6 and noses at 14 and 15 for girls and boys, and breast surgery around 18 to 20. The answer is that the non-invasives are excellent in your younger years, uh-huh. in your 20s, in your 30s, some people into your 40s. But for example, I don't know if you could see my face right now.
But yes, I can.
But as we get older, the face moves forward and downward. Very, very sad. We rather have it ever so gently upward and backward, but never pulled. The whole right. key to this field is to look like nobody touched you.
Right.
You have to look natural, understated, not tampered with. So in the younger ages, these ancillary things like Botox, fillers, lasers, peels, radio frequency microneedling can tighten the skin and can produce a more rejuvenated, youthful face without using the scalpel. However, when people get older and their cheek starts to overlap their nasolabial fold,
right.
or other things happen, the only way to fix it is surgically, because it resuspends for a good 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And
It is not to jump into a facelift surgery at 30, but at that age, you might want to try the non-invasives because they are not as invasive.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that, of course, I love about your practice is Michelle yes. Melpesia, who is an RN and who I have certainly visited on numerous times, who, you know, does absolutely beautiful, beautiful work.
Terrific.
And of course, her expertise is the non-surgical series of things that are available,
correct.
Right?
Yeah. Including bioidentical hormones, thread lifts, PRP for a thinning scalp. That's all Michelle, and she is extraordinary at it. My part is the surgical improvement of the face, eyes, nose, chin, breasts, tummy, and lipo, but mm-hmm. mostly above the clavicles for me mm-hmm. at this age.
Right. No, and it's a great partnership, and I've certainly seen that. A number of people who knew you were going to be on the show today, they wanted me to ask you some very specific questions, beginning with breasts. Okay. Uh-huh. Breast augmentation versus breast lift versus breast reduction. What explain. Give us some information about all of this.
Okay, so if you think of the breast, it's made up of two elements, a skin envelope, which is basically the skin that contains the nipple areola complex.
Mm-hmm.
The other element is its volume. The volume is breast tissue and fat. So a woman that has very small breasts may want a little more volume. And in that case, I will put a small breast implant in, always through the armpit. I don't like any marks on a woman's chest.
Uh-huh.
I put it in where the woman shaves in a 1-inch incision, develop the pocket behind the pectoralis major muscle, and it is like a shot in the arm like you can't believe. So that's pure volume. That's a breast augmentation. Uh-huh. Now, what happens if the breast is falling? It's falling because the skin envelope is now stretched, usually secondary to pregnancy or the loss of a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of the volume, I must do a breast lift or a mastopexy to take away the excess volume from the bottom, reposition the nipples higher up, and sometimes actually add an implant if volume is the problem also. But a breast lift means removing skin because you're lifting your nipple areola complex to a higher position. A breast reduction means just what it says. You're going to reduce the skin envelope because the breast is very large, and you're going to reduce the volume, which means you must take out gland and fat also. And it's a very specific pattern that's used, but when it's done, it's magnificent. The nipples are up in the center. Most people throw a t-shirt on over with nothing under, and they're pretty happy.
Other women wanted me to ask you about sensation. Okay, they either have a breast augmentation or a breast lift or breast reduction. How does this or does this affect the feeling?
Okay, augmentation, since it's done from the armpit, I'm not even near the breast. I'm behind the pectoralis major muscle, so there's no breast even touching the implant. Sensation should be 100% return. Okay. On a mastopexy or a lift, as you called it, as well as a breast reduction, you should still retain sensation. We know where those nerves are, and by using or implementing a pedicle technique that carries the nerves to the nipple, the sensation should, in almost all cases, remain the same. Of course, there's a case here and there with an aberrant innervation where one might have diminished sensation or lose sensation, but I would say that's extremely rare. You should go into all of those breast procedures with the knowledge and understanding that you're going to retain sensation.
Well, that is good news. And I know that there are people who are listening who really wanted me to pose these questions to you. Now, if we're talking about the body, okay, tummy tuck, you know, liposuction. I mean, there's so many different things, right, that you're able to do to tone up and firm up and M-sculpt. And there's just many things. And again, we're a little confused as a consumer.
Okay, so basically we live in this body and years go by with us in it. And we remember the tautness of our skin when we were very young. But some people gain weight, much more weight than they'd want to, and then they lose it. Or some people decide to have children, which is very common. You have a child, the breasts get enormous, the tummy expands, the baby's born, and now the tummy skin is flapping in the wind, right, and the breasts are deflated and sagging. That's called a mommy makeover. That's when we do a breast lift with an implant at the same time as a tummy tuck to remove that excess skin. Incisions for the breasts are sewn like an Armani suit in five different layers around the areola and vertically. And the incisions for the tummy tuck are sewn below the bathing suit line, also extremely carefully in five separate layers.
Wow. I mean, that's good to know. And so then where does liposuction fit into this?
So liposuction is a fantastic mechanism to remove fat that won't go despite diet and exercise. You must diet and exercise first. It's the healthiest way. It's the safest way. But there are certain areas, in females particularly, the outer thighs, the inner thighs, sometimes the inner knees, sometimes the flanks and the axillary fat near the armpit. In men, we tend to gather fat like a tire. It's lower abdomen, flanks around to the back. So once one diets and exercises as best they can, if those areas are still fatty, through a 1/64th of an inch aperture, I can pass a cannula that's basically like a hollow straw. And every time I pass the cannula, a volume of fat comes out into a receptacle. And I watch the skin coming down, down, down until it's nice and snug like it was.
Now, it's amazing that the technology that is available today. I mean, you know, even for you over all these years, it's changed a lot, right? There's so many new things.
Always. That's why I love the field.
And I know, because I know you, I know that you absolutely love the field. And what about, for example, again, somebody asked me yesterday here in Sarasota, well, what does Dr. Weintraub think about AmSculpt? So explain for the listeners what AmSculpt is and tell us what you think about this technology.
I'm not the biggest favor of it. A fan of it. It basically uses electrical impulses to hypertrophy muscle. So it's not taking out fat, it's hypertrophying muscles by electrical stimulation. If your muscles get a little firmer, then the overlying skin will become a little tighter, but it's very, very variable.
Interesting. Some other questions that people wanted me to ask you. I mean, online you can buy all kinds of devices that say that they're going to tighten the skin and firm things. Is there anything to this, or is this just, you know, capitalism around the world trying to sell us, you know, something else?
You know, some things do work for a very short period of time. But there's no long-term anything that doesn't require medical intervention and FDA approval. If you think of cosmetics, I mean, they're basically lotions and potions. If the skin is dry, then you moisturize it. If it's if it's moist, dry it. And some of the other skin erase things are temporary. Now, temporary may be fine for some people, but most people want a long-term result. And what they're going after, is this is a good thing to remember. Surgery fixes folds. Whenever there's a fold, it's fixed by surgery permanently. Lasers fix fabric. So the laser fixes the quality of the skin. Might it be cardboard? We want it to be silk. Surgery fixes the folds. The laser then fixes the fabric. And they're used together, jointly.
They are definitely used together. So what else should we know? What else? I mean, people are listening, and I know that there are a lot of people, you know, had asked me, oh my goodness, Dr. Weintraub is coming on, and I'm thinking about doing this, but I'm not sure. I mean, what other things should the consumer know about if they are contemplating, you know, facial plastic surgery or plastic surgery to the body? What should they be thinking about, and what should we know, and what should we not be wasting our money on?
Well, certainly you interview that doctor just like he's interviewing you, and you check out where he went to school, how long he is in practice, where he has hospital appointments, and if he or she is in good standings, if they are indeed board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery.
Right.
And any awards or other high credential items you will find on Google. I can tell you a couple of secrets that people may want to ask.
We want secrets. We want your secrets. Yes.
Okay, so sometimes I have a whole series of patients where I've performed eyelid surgery, mid-face suspension, removal of jowls, sharpening of jawline, and a comprehensive neck lift when the neck is falling and the jowls are falling. And I've noticed over the years, and that will rejuvenate someone tremendously, but if somebody has a hook nose or a tip that's plunging when they smile, the nose is negative in that case, even though you're fixing the face, jawline, and neck. So I have a series, which I'll show you one day if you'd like to pop them on the air or talk about them. Of women who have chosen to do their nose at the same time as their face, eyes, and neck. And it knocks off about another 15, 20 years. Because if the nose has a gentle slope and the slightest lift to it, I'm not talking about scooped out or turned up, but just with female tip-defining points or male tip-defining points, instead of something that's convex pointing to the floor, it augments your facelift result. So adding the nose into a facial surgery, I have found to be unbelievably augmentative.
So interesting. Now, in your practice, it's a wide age range.
Yes, it's a wide age range. So the younger folks, of course, will do the things that are done by younger folks, the breast augmentations, rhinoplasties, sometimes a liposuction. The facelift surgery, as I mentioned, is usually done after, let's say, 47, 48, through your 50s, 60s, 70s, and above if you're healthy.
Are you finding also that, of course, we're in New York, but are more and more men starting to give themselves permission to do a little bit of this?
About 25 to 30% of my practice are men. And you would be amazed. They ask for basically the same things. If their eyelids are heavy, they want a blepharoplasty. If there's a big bump in the nose with a down pointed tip, they want a neat straight profile with some tip to tail. If the face is falling forward and down, particularly in men, the neck can be very, very heavy.
Right.
They may want their neck defatted and then resuspended like a hammock. The jowls are removed, the jawline is sharpened, and the midface is all suspended from the inside of the ear. You do this so that you don't see the incisions, and those are little tricks that take time, and one should never be in a rush. My practice is not a factory here. I can only operate 2 days a week, and I usually do a case at 7:30 and another one at 1 o'clock, and that's it.
I'm not going to mention his name because I could get sued, Dr. Weintraub. But I know a facial plastic surgeon who's very well known in the country who does 7 facelifts a day.
Insanity.
Insanity.
To me, that's insanity. See, that means that the dissection is hastily done.
Wow.
The bleeding aspects aren't hastily done because you've got to be meticulous about bleeding.
Right.
And
right.
Either he's using or she is using staples or has someone else there to close those surgeries. It's not physically possible to do 7 facelifts well in one day. By example, I only do one.
Really?
Yes. Sometimes if it's a husband and wife, I'll actually split the day and do both of them, and they go to the same hotel room in the Pierre across the street for 2 nights. Then the headdressings come off on the morning of the 3rd day, and the nurse lathers up their hair, and then they go home.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because after, for example, if somebody has a facelift, so you're recommending that they don't go home that night or day.
Absolutely not. I think it's not safe. I think people are trying to cut corners and save money in the wrong places. After a facelift is done, you have blood pressure issues. Men have beards. They can bleed more. In my book, they must be around a visiting nurse for 2 nights. Now, that can be in their home if they're near me, or we have an arrangement with the Pierre for much reduced room rates, as well as the Plaza in New York. And only 2 nights with a visiting nurse, I can then visit them.
Right.
And then the headdressing will come off the morning of the 3rd day.
I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, I love about your practice and also about Michelle, is that you're not running a factory.
It isn't. You can't.
No.
You never look at the clock. You know, medicine and money don't mix. You have to love this stuff. I mean, for me, when I go into that room, it's like going into art class. I get to sculpt people. And it's almost, I mean, it's magnificent that I found this field, because there's nothing else I can think of that I'd rather do more.
Did you always, when you were younger, did you always want to be a plastic surgeon?
I didn't know. I had a friend of my father's when I was very young, playing tennis at 13. He basically just said, when you come back next week, tell me what you love to do that doesn't feel like work. So I thought about it, and the only thing I could come up with was, I told him I love my plants, my animals, and I love science. And he always had one word for me, year in, year out: keep doing it, keep doing it.
Yeah.
And I went into college and majored in biochemistry. Barry, keep doing it. I went to Cornell School of Medicine. keep doing it. In other words, what he was saying to me was find your passion.
Absolutely.
If you can find your passion, work is not work. It's right. actually fun. And yeah. cosmetic surgery is particularly fantastic because it's the only field that combines medical science and artwork at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's what attracted me.
No, I mean, I feel exactly, you know, the same way about what I do about psychotherapists and sex therapists and, you know, people in the media. I mean, it's fun. Fortunately, we're very well trained. But for me, too, it's a passion. I never, even when I have really difficult cases at times, it's a passion. I love the people that I work with, and we're very fortunate.
We get to really do this.
Another question, a procedure type question. What do you think about microneedling?
So, a few years ago, the concept of making little holes in the skin,
yes,
tended to bear out. That those little injuries cause the dermal layers, which are below the epidermis, to make more elastin and collagen. And those are the building blocks of strong, smooth skin. So in the beginning, we were running a microneedling device up and down. The face would have a little blood, but then we started adding serums to it. So now you've got these holes in the face. And if you add certain vitamins and other stimulants to the dermis, you start to produce beautifully smooth skin. Well, the technology's gotten even further to radio frequency microneedling. So what does that mean? That means an energy source is making the holes, stimulating the elastin and collagen, and actually contracting the skin by about 30%. So the radio frequency actually heats the dermis slightly, so the skin contracts on itself. There, too, on our machines, you can insert certain serums, vitamin serums, so that once the hole is made, and again, they're microscopic, the important nutritional elements get in, and it does work.
So interesting. I mean, do you do that, or does Michelle?
Michelle and Sanella. We have Michelle is our aesthetic nurse and Sanella is our esthetician. And they have some overlap, but they do everything that's non-invasive.
See, that's amazing. So I would guess, I mean, this is just a guess, that doing the microneedling with the radio frequency could be an alternative, let's say, for the lower eyelid.
Correct. So what I've done in more than 15 years is I approach the lower eyelids from the back part of the lid, from the pink part of the lid, to take the fat out. If someone has baggy eyelids, I no longer make an incision under the lashes. When I look at other patients from other offices, I can always tell. It's a giveaway because on one side, there may be more white showing than another, and it's just a lousy way to get to the fat pads. I put a guard on the cornea. I get the fat pads from the pink side. But as you're alluding to, Beatty, the skin of the lower lids, I laser. And I'll either laser it with our erbium profractional laser, or I'll laser it with the RF microneedling, the radio frequency. So that, as I said, improves the quality of the skin because the lower eyelid skin is very, very crepey. We want it to be a little smoother.
So you're a real artist, and that was something, again, that I don't know about you, but do you paint? Do you draw? Do you sculpt?
It's so funny. I used to.
You did.
Many, many years ago, both sculpting, wood, metal, but now the medium is alive for me. So every day I go into the office, it's a new canvas. It's a new sculpture. Yeah. Always making somebody look like it's them. No distortion. No radical tightening. You're not to look like you're in a wind tunnel. You're to look like yourself maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Right. You know, before we began the show today, and I'm not going to make you jealous, I was sitting at the pool at the hotel, and I told the man I was going to be interviewing you. And, you know, he started to mention so many of the Hollywood actors who've had such terrible, terrible facelifts and terrible facial surgery. And frankly, Dr. Weintraub, as I walk around New York City, and I know a lot of women who've had, you know, a lot of work done, it hasn't been great.
Right. So if that upsets you, imagine how I feel, because one of my colleagues did that to someone.
Okay.
So when I see that, I'm as upset as you are. And the reason for that is some people should just not be in this field.
Right.
This is not like taking out a kidney or a gallbladder.
Yeah.
You have to have an artistic sense. And you also have to know what path you're going on to make sure the case is done when it's done. Otherwise, how do you know it's finished? You have to see it before you perform it. And that's a very important point.
And you have to care, and you have to be honest, and you have to take the time.
All of that.
And,
sure.
And it has got to be more than just about the bottom line.
Yes, you have to love it. And I'll tell you this, and so did my dad's friend tell me, if you love what you do and you do it consistently, you will earn a very handsome living, and in some cases more money than you can count, because people come to you when you're doing something well.
Right.
There's an old proverb that goes, the more you give, the bigger you are. You feel large when you're giving, which is the way I feel when I'm doing surgery, and sometimes I'll do pro bono things.
Yeah.
The more you give, the bigger you are. The more you take, the smaller you become.
I love it.
So for the listeners out there, be a giver. And if you think you've given a lot, give more. Mm-hmm. And you'll sleep really well.
I don't think that I have ever heard a doctor, not that I interview too many doctors. In fact, I don't have too many guests on my show, unless it's somebody in, you know, whatever field, in psychiatry or in medicine, that I have an enormous amount of respect for. I've never used this show as a promotional tool for anybody. So as a result, I don't have too many people that I really care to interview. And I've never heard anybody put it like this. I've never heard anybody say this in the way you've just expressed about the importance of giving.
Here's another good one. Sometimes patients will come in, and you alluded to it, they can become obsessive about what they're looking at.
Right.
And they're actually driving themselves crazy over millimeters and minutiae. So the proverb I give them is, nobody looks at you like you look at you.
Right.
Nobody looks at you like you look at you. Don't sweat the minutiae. Let's look at the detailed things that can really help you, but don't sweat it so that you're obsessing over very, very fine things. And there's a corollary to that proverb, and it goes like this. And this is for the patient that keeps coming back. The Michael Jackson syndrome.
Right, right.
The proverb is this, and this is what I tell them. In plastic surgery, and if you're going to keep doing it, the enemy of good is better.
Yes.
The enemy of good is better, because eventually someone's going to look distorted or have a complication. If you remember Michael Jackson's nose before he died.
Absolutely.
And God bless him, it wasn't his fault. It was the doctor that kept doing that to him.
Right.
And that makes me angry in and of itself. But the enemy of good is better. Accept the change. Know that it's for improvement. If you're expecting absolute perfection, sometimes it comes, but it doesn't always.
No, exactly. You know, one of my columns that I wrote in Dan's papers was about, I think the heading was, and what about an inside makeover? Uh-huh. You know, we can focus on the external, on this and on that. And sometimes what people really need to be focusing on is to take a look at what's really going on inside.
Well, here's how I phrase that. When people are talking with me about all these changes they want to make, I will say something like, this is only the paint job on the car. Cosmetic surgery is a paint job. And then I will point to their chest and I will say the motor has to be running right before you begin to fix the paint job. Mm-hmm. So the motor is first. That tells me if someone's a good candidate. They mm-hmm. have to be coming from a reasonably honest, non-obsessive place. Then mm-hmm. the paint job will come out fine.
Exactly. I just love what you're saying. I love who you are. I really look forward to, you know, to getting to know you better and working with you. And of course, getting out on the tennis courts. Any last word that you want to leave for the people who are listening right now?
Let's see.
Okay.
Basically, love yourself. Be happy with yourself. Yeah. If there's something you see that's bugging you, know there's excellent professional help out there. Know where to get it. Don't obsess. Understand that less is more. Being conservative and looking untampered with is the name of the game, particularly in noses. You want to look like you were born with that nasal structure. But use these tools that myself, Michelle, and Sunella have to offer gingerly because they're just the paint job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love it.
Betty to your motor.
right. I hope you have enjoyed this interchange as much as I have, Dr. Weintraub. I mean, I was really looking forward to talking with you, of course, today in depth about all of this. You're such a man, Sheer. You're an artist, and
thank you very much. The feeling's mutual.
Yeah, and listen, we'll see each other soon. I'll be back in New York in a couple of weeks. And
bring your racket.
I will. I'm playing 3 times a week now here. And I'm not even going to say anything. I mean, the sun, the sky, it's beautiful. The clay courts are great. So I'm feeling very happy and very, very happy to have connected with you. And I'll see you soon. And thanks so much again.
Thank you very much. You're an inspiration to your listeners. I'll tell you that.
Well, thank you. And you're an inspiration to my listeners and to your patients. Love you dearly, honey. Bye. Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. What a great, great, great interview. And what a lovely, lovely man. And, you know, for those of you who know me, you've been listening to the show for all these years, you know that I don't have too many guests on the Ask Beattie Show. And the people, you know, who I do have are people who I know and people who I respect. Because referrals, they're really, really gold. And if I'm sending somebody to someone who is really not up to speed, I mean, it's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt my reputation. You know, and talking about reputations, and this is something, you know, probably this is not going to be the most politically correct thing that I could possibly say on radio. But, you know, I've lived in New York now since 2014. And I am desperate to find a psychiatrist who I trust. Some of my patients, they need medication, on occasion hospitalization. And I have to say, I've really struck out. I've gotten referrals from different people. And if anybody, see if you can help me, okay? You know, the theme song of my show, the Beatles song, Help. But if any of you have either had experiences or know of a really honest, great doctor who's going to take the time and who's not going to, you know, charge you $500 or $750 for a 20-minute session or a 20-minute initial evaluation, I would really, really love if you could contact me. And my website, of course, is beattiecohn.com, because this is something that I am really lacking in my practice. And it's really a frightening thing when you're in a big, big city like New York City and you don't have the confidence in referring patients to, in quotes, some of the top so-called psychiatrists in the city. And maybe this is something I should have probably asked Dr. Weintraub, you know, during the show. But again, if you know of anyone, if you actually happen to be a patient with anybody who you really respect their expertise, I hope that you will really let me know. And I also really want want to hear from you about today's interview. This for me was a very, very special. It was a special interview with a very special man. And when you're listening to this, you can hear the honesty, you can hear the passion, you can hear the goodness. And, you know, when I talk about how careful we have to be, you know, who we let in our lives, I mean, mostly, of course, you know, I'm talking about relationships and significant others and partners. And yet it is so, so true how we have to make good assessments. And it's not just by referrals, you know, if we are, you know, deciding that we want to really date somebody, if we're deciding, you know, over and above that we want to marry someone, because just continue to look at the statistics. I mean, when I wrote the book and it came out in 2000, I mean, I was hoping with all the self-help books and all the talk on mental health and relationships that we were going to see a change. We were going to see a positive change in terms of what was going on in the world of relationships. And the reality is we've seen no change at all. Actually, that's not true. We've seen increasing negative changes. I mean, look at the divorce rate. We have a divorce rate in this country, despite all of the self-help, you know, books and therapists and coaches and people, 48%. And the divorce rate for second marriages, and I'll always ask people, so what do you think the divorce rate for second marriages is? And they'll give me a number, but the number is usually wrong. That number is 67%. And what about the divorce rate for third marriages? And again, people are very surprised to hear this number. That number is between 72 and 73%. So we are absolutely learning nothing about relationships, despite all of the talk about mental health and therapists and coaching. And I'm very, very clear, and I've been very critical of people in the mental health profession and have not been afraid to actually speak out. I think that in many, many cases, just like Dr. Weintraub was talking about taking, you know, shortcuts, I think that a lot of people are taking in the mental health field are taking a lot of shortcuts. And you cannot simply put a bandage on trauma or on depression. You have to get in deep, and you have to help people get to the root of the problem, even though we can't change our history. And then I look at the teenage dating abuse statistics, and it's awful. When I was a kid growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, whoever knew about teenage dating abuse? And if we're looking at domestic violence, 3 women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. So again, we have a lot of work to do in this field. And as always, I want to thank you all so much for being loyal listeners, you know, for all these years. And I want to leave you with my 2 weekly messages. And the first, just as Dr. Weintraub mentioned, we need to do everything that we can possibly do with help, without help, to really learn to love ourselves. And secondarily, and this is really important, given the climate that we have internationally and in the United States, if we're looking at racism and we're looking at income inequality, that we need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other. So again, thank you so much for listening, and have a good rest of the day. And I will talk with you next week. And every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So remember to love yourself, love each other, be giving, as Dr. Weintraub was reminding all of us. And if we follow this recipe, we have a really good shot at improving the quality of our lives and our relationships. So goodbye, everybody, and be well. Talk with you next week. Bye.